All right, this is the Patriot Act and You. For those of you who are looking for attacking and securing FTP, I believe that's on the roof. Following my talk in this room, there will be Ryan Lackey with Net Cash. That's C-A-S-H, cash. Okay, now first I want to ask whether anyone in this room has an objection to being filmed. That's okay if you do. Okay, I see some people with their hands up, so your faces will not be filmed. But this is being recorded, so just so you know. Okay, I'm Jennifer Granick. I'm a lawyer, and I work at Stanford Law School. Before I worked at Stanford Law School, I was a criminal defense attorney, and I represented people in all sorts of criminal cases, but also in computer crime cases, particularly for people who were charged with illegal hacking. I now work at the Center for Internet and Society, which is an organization in the law school concerned with the public interest and law and technology, specifically computer technology. I teach a class there in public interest internet law in which we take cases that are about free speech or privacy on the internet. We litigate those cases pro bono, and students work on the cases with me, gaining practical experience, in case you guys are wondering how I normally spend my day. There we go. I'm going to talk about the Patriot Act today, and I think that some people may not make it all the way through to the end, though some will, so I put the most important part first. The most important part is the question, what can I do if I don't like the way that the law is going? And I've listed here some suggestions for how you can educate yourself more about the laws that I'm going to speak about today and what you can do. Obviously, democracy is imperfect, but we are a democracy, and it can make a difference if a lot of people call their congressperson and help that person understand why these issues matter. I think that there is a lot of ignorance on the part of lawmakers as to what exactly we're doing here today and what's going on in the computer security world and why we don't have to be so fearful of people who are knowledgeable about computers. There we go. Okay, I'm going to talk about three different laws today, especially if I have time. The first thing I'm going to talk about is the US APA or the USA Patriot Act. And I'm also going to talk about, and that's a law that's been passed. It was passed following September 11th, though it was drafted before that. And the provisions in that law were something that law enforcement had been seeking for quite some time. I'm also going to talk about two laws that are proposed and are not yet actually in force. That is the CSEA law, which is amendments to the anti-hacking law, and also a hack-back law, which is very amusing and would, if passed, give the RIAA and other copyright holders the right to hack in order to defend their copyrighted works. So I think we'll find that to be an amusing prospect as well. Okay, so earlier today, BK asked me what Patriot stands for, and I actually didn't know, but it was better than I could have imagined. It stands for Provide Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. So that's what Patriot means. I prefer to call it the USAPA. I think it's a little more neutral and a little less political. Essentially, what the USAPA does is it increases the government's ability to perform surveillance on electronic networks and of electronic data. Okay, that's one of its main provisions. Now, this is an area, how great that increase is an area of some dispute between myself and the person who spoke on this topic at Black Hat, Mark Eckenweiler. And I think I noticed some of Mark's colleagues from the Department of Justice in the audience today, and so there may be some heckling from them, and that could be good. But I did fight this out with Mark earlier, and I think that we've come to some common ground. There are some significant increases in government power. I'm going to be discussing those. How important you think those are, perhaps, is a matter of perspective, that perspective being whether you are, in fact, with the government or not. And I trust that most of you are on my side on this. So. The second major change, and this is something that I think is of a concern perhaps for everybody, is that it alters rules that have been in effect since the 1970s about the interrelationship between foreign intelligence services and domestic law enforcement. So following the 60s and 70s, when there were abuses by the government of surveillance powers showing, and there was showing that they had been surveilling and infiltrating domestic groups like the Black Panthers and anti-war groups, rules were placed into effect to divide foreign intelligence from law enforcement and make those two things operate under under separate rules. And foreign intelligence, will, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, basically was to investigate people who were agents of a foreign government, whereas domestic law enforcement was to enforce the domestic criminal laws. Okay. And then the third thing that this act does is it defines more criminal acts as terrorist offenses than were previously called terrorists, and some of those acts are certain types of hacking. Okay, so before people get upset, I just want to say not all hacking is redefined as a terrorist offense, but some hacking is. And we'll be talking specifically about the circumstances under which that's the case. Okay, now government surveillance is not all necessarily a bad thing, in my opinion. I think there's probably some people out there who might even disagree with that. But government surveillance allows the apprehension and the prevention of crime. The question is not whether there should be some government surveillance, but under what circumstances. And under the structure that's currently, or that was currently, that was established prior to Patriot Act, essentially the there were a couple of distinctions that were made, and there was different tools that law enforcement, or different permissions that law enforcement would need to get before they could acquire certain information. So for example, in order to tap your telephone, law enforcement needs to have a wiretap order, and there are some strict requirements before you can get a wiretap order and listen in on somebody's phone calls. Okay. Now, essentially what the Patriot Act did, so the hallmark of wiretap order, search warrant, and other types of, most other types of court orders is that the government has to go and make some kind of factual showing to the judge. And the judge, a neutral and detached person, will review this information, and if it's sufficient, if it meets the criteria, then they will issue the court order or the warrant. And the criteria varies, whether you need to have probable cause or whether you need to have a suspicion or what that criteria is, depending upon how private the information is. Okay. So what the Patriot Act did was it either redefined certain information as requiring less, as having less privacy and requiring a lower showing before a judge, before the before law enforcement can find it, or it created or defined new types of information as under new categories. So whereas before we didn't know, and I'll talk about this a little more in a bit, before we didn't know what type of showing law enforcement might need in order to get information about what credit card you use to pay your ISP, now we know what that, now we know what showing that is, and it is lower, perhaps, than some of us would have argued, okay? So the thing that we're looking for in government surveillance is what's the showing that the government needs to make to get the information, and is there judicial oversight and some kind of neutral regulation or monitoring of when law enforcement gets information and how it's used? Okay, so I'm not advocating for no government surveillance whatsoever, but what I do advocate for is stronger judicial oversight and review. And what the Patriot Act has done is sort of, in my opinion, dumbed everything down a little bit and shifted many things to a lower category. Okay, that appears to have been a technological difficulty having nothing to do with any kind of political opinions of anybody here. We'll see if it happens again. So a subpoena is something that I can draft in my office, okay? A subpoena requires no judicial oversight or review whatsoever. It's simply something that is issued by any party, but in this case it would be issued by the prosecution. And that it was always true that subscriber information was available that way, but what we did not know, and what was not clear under the law, is what sort of legal process you would need to get IP addresses, session information, duration of connection times, and payment information. And arguably, that was information that was available with a different type of order, which we call a 2703D order. And that is something where you go to the judge and you have to show specific and articulable facts that give rise to the cause to have this information. Now, after the Patriot Act, that information is available with a subpoena. So previously you had judicial oversight before that. Now a subpoena is sufficient for law enforcement to get your payment information, including bank account and credit card numbers from your ISP. Okay. Now, prior to the Patriot Act, email headers were arguably content data. Okay, and this was, and this falls in under the scheme under the ECPA. And it's a very complicated law. I'm going to try to summarize how it works very quickly. And of course, there's always exceptions. But basically, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, this protects the privacy of electronic communications. And under the act, there are two separate distinctions it makes. One is between content data, and two is between non-content data. So with an email, content data is the text of the email. Non-content data would be information about the routing of the email, and in this case is the header information. So those two things are treated differently, with content information receiving much greater protection, being considered a much more private thing. A little bit like a normal letter. If you have a letter and it's sealed, the letter inside is private, but who it's addressed to on the outside, anybody can see. And then the second distinction they make is between the real-time acquisition of communications, which would be like a sniffer or an interception in some way, and the collection of historical data, data that is stored or collected by your ISP. And generally, although with a little bit of a, well, I don't know if this is actually true in the case of non-content data, but with content data, interception is protected. Real-time interception requires a much greater showing than the collection of historical data. Okay, so for example, to tap your telephone, you need this very special type of warrant that's more difficult to get even than a search warrant, which is called a Title III warrant. I'll explain a little bit about that in a moment, to gain access to email that's stored on your ISP's server. You only need, if your email's unopened, a search warrant, and if your email is opened, then I think it's a subpoena with notice, so you get some notice in advance so you can challenge whether they should have the right to your email or not. But you can see that stored information is treated, it's much easier to get stored information than it is to intercept information on the fly. Okay, so before the Patriot Act, email headers, the to, from, subject line, were arguably content data because it tells you who it's going to, who it's from, and what it's about, and that what it's about is really content. Now, the law says that email headers are obtainable with a pen register or trap and trace order. Now, the pen register, trap and trace order is something that comes to us from the days when we didn't have the internet, when all we had was telephone. And in the days of telephone, law enforcement can find out what numbers you're dialing and what numbers are calling in to you. And to get a pen register or a trap and trace order, I want to make sure in the law, the exact language is always critical. So you need to simply certify to the court that the information that you're looking for is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, and once that certification is made, then the judge must issue the pen register, trap, and trace order. The big debate on this question is whether the subject line, which tells you what the email is about, is in fact header information or is content information, and my understanding is that the Department of Justice position on this is that the subject line is content information, and you do need to get, in order to intercept it, you do need to get a Title III warrant. So if that is in fact their policy, that's good news for us. Because otherwise, it's really a great step down in terms of the type of showing that law enforcement needs to make in order to find out what we're sending each other emails about. Similarly, with transaction information, with web surfing, when you're requesting a web page, the URL can often tell a lot about what you're asking for information about and what kind of information you're getting back. Arguably, that was content data, subject to the Title III warrant or to a 2703D order. Now that type of transaction information is obtainable with a pen register or trap and trace order. I think I omitted talking about what the Title III warrant requires, so I just want to go back and touch on that now. A Title III warrant requires, like a normal search warrant, an affidavit based on probable cause, which then goes to a judge, and the judge issues the warrant. But in addition, a Title III warrant, a warrant to intercept, is only available for certain offenses. It's only available if you've shown that that interception is necessary to get the information that you're looking for. And once the order is authorized, you have to minimize, which means that, for example, with telephones, you can't listen to every single telephone conversation that the subject who you're investigating is involved in. You can only listen to the ones that are incriminating. So, for example, if any of you have watched The Simpsons, you can see them minimizing, and not The Simpsons, I'm sorry, my other favorite show, The Sopranos. If you, when they were monitoring Tony Soprano's phone calls, they had every 2 minutes, you know, they listen, oh, he's talking to his daughter, they're not allowed to listen to that, then they can pick up 2 minutes later, now he's talking to one of his capos, so it's okay for them to listen in. So you have to minimize, okay? And then you also have to report back to the judge every 30 days as to how it's going. So the Title III warrant is very hard to get, very privacy protective. For searches of email content, when the emails are stored on your ISP's, in your ISP's system, if the emails are unopened, you need a search warrant. If you've opened the emails, then you need a subpoena, though you do, as the subscriber, have a right to notice. Under the Patriot Act, law enforcement now has an extended ability to delay notice and to search the for the information without giving you any forewarning. Before the Patriot Act, you had to obtain authorization for your wiretap, that Title III warrant I was just speaking about, in the district where the telephone or a computer was located. Now we have roving wiretaps, which means that once you get the authorization in any one district, you can follow the suspect around and then tap any phone or device that he or she uses. Another change is voicemail. In the old days, voicemail required the very privacy-protecting Title III warrant, just as you needed one to intercept your phone communications to collect those voicemail communications, you needed to go through the same process. Now all law enforcement needs is a search warrant. Now a search warrant is privacy-protective, but certainly quite a bit less privacy-protective and available in many more situations than a Title III warrant is. So that is also a major change. Before the Patriot Act, you needed a court order in order to monitor any computer user. Now, this is a debate that I had with Mark, but one of the changes that the Patriot Act made is that it indicates that if computer use is unauthorized, then law enforcement may monitor, without a court order, all it needs is the permission of the system owner. Arguably before, whether the use was authorized or unauthorized, the user may have had an expectation of privacy and you needed to go get a court order for monitoring. The Department of Justice position was that computer trespassers never had an expectation of privacy, which I always find an interesting kind of argument. If you're not breaking the law, then you have an expectation of privacy, but if you are breaking the law, you don't have an expectation of privacy, so really we should never need any warrants, because only people who are breaking the law, for people who are breaking the law, you don't need one, and the rest of us are innocent. But that is the Department of Justice's view on this. In their view, the Patriot Act didn't change this. In my view, it is a change. And it takes away judicial oversight of monitoring and puts it in the hands of law enforcement. One of the main concerns that people have had about this is the nature of, or the question of what is unauthorized. And the term unauthorized has been very broadly interpreted, not so much in court opinions, because we don't have a lot of court opinions on this topic, but in the civil arena, and in terms of prosecutions. Essentially, unauthorized means that the system owner didn't say you could, or it's something that, you know, was understood that you were not supposed to be able to do. My position's always been that while we may have a social consensus about what's authorized and not authorized in the physical world, that consensus is not at all universal or near universal in the digital world, and what's considered beyond the pale or trespassing or something that you're not supposed to do is subject to much greater differences of opinion on the part of reasonable people. So one of the main concerns is something as simple as, is unauthorized access something as simple as using the system outside of the terms of service? So that if my terms of service for my ISP say that I'm not going to be using it for copyright infringement, and then they think that I'm trading wares or MP3s or I'm on Grokster or something like that, does that mean that all of a sudden they can monitor my use without going and getting a court order? Is that therefore unauthorized access? So I think this is a broad hole that the USAPA opens up in previously protected in previously protected information. And again, as I said, I'm not saying this information should never be available. The question is, what standards must law enforcement meet, and do we have judicial oversight before before the access can occur? Okay. Prior to the Act, ISPs were not permitted to disclose information to law enforcement without a court order or the consent of the party, or in certain other cases. But the main difference now is that ISPs are given the power to voluntarily disclose non-content information to law enforcement without a court order if it is to protect the provider's rights and property or under threat of death or injury. And while I don't have any real problem necessarily with that kind of voluntary disclosure under the threat of death or serious injury, there are many, many circumstances which can be interpreted as something about protecting the provider's rights and property. And again, that opens up a great area in which ISPs can voluntarily work with law enforcement. And I think that perhaps some of our law enforcement people could perhaps confirm this for me. Law enforcement certainly has a great way to incentivize people to voluntarily cooperate. New terrorism offenses. The definition of domestic terrorism was changed, and I doubt that the people there in the back can read this. I don't want to read the whole thing out loud, but basically the definition of domestic terrorism was changed to something that many people in the civil rights community have a concern that legitimate protest activity could be interpreted as domestic terrorism if it occurs in a situation where something violent then happens. And I think that if any of you have been activists or protesters or that kind of thing, I think that you know that sometimes, or if you even watch the news and watch the WTO protests and that kind of thing, I think you know that sometimes you can go to some kind of activist event, and sometimes some people will break the law, and sometimes violence breaks out, and sometimes things get out of control when you're in a crowd. And one of our great concerns is that in situations where that happens, suddenly those will be considered to be domestic terrorism as opposed to just, you know, rioting or failure to disperse or something like that. Why does that matter? It matters because terrorism is treated much more harshly than other crimes. Okay? And we'll talk about that in a second. Some hacking is now classified as terrorism. And this I will read for the people in the back. 1030A1, which is obtaining classified information that could be used to harm the United States or disclosing that information to a foreign government. That was always true. Okay, that was always criminal. Well, I don't think it was terrorism, but that was always a very serious offense. And then the new 1030A5A sub 1, which is the transmission of a program, information, software, et cetera, which intentionally causes damage to interfere with someone's medical information that would create physical injury, that creates a threat to public health or safety, or that damages the a governmental system that is used for the administration of justice, for defense, or for security. Okay? So not all computer hacking is classified as terrorism, but what they did basically is rewrite 1030A5 and spell out specific types of damage and then classify unauthorized access in which those types of damage occur as being hacking, or rather, I'm sorry, terrorist offenses. Now, what's my problem with this? Do I have a problem with making it a crime to try to injure somebody with hacking? Well, I don't think trying to physically injure somebody or deleting people's medical information or anything like that is good. One of my biggest problems with this, one of my biggest problems with this is what I mentioned before about the vague and fuzzy nature of the concept of unauthorized access. And I think that laws which say you can't try to mess with somebody's medical information, you can't try to cause physical injury to someone, you can't try to disable government systems for justice, defense, and security are better than laws which try to convert that into some type of hacking and then hinge that on this very vague and amorphous concept of unauthorized access, which can be a very broad thing. Basically, what we're doing is we're opening this up to chance. And I have had the experience of many cases where the notion of unauthorized access is it's really not all that descriptive. I've had people charged with unauthorized access for where there's no real access shown. I've had people charged with a transmission of harmful information for sending emails that the company didn't like to have sent to them. So this is a very vague concept, and actually something that I'm going to be working on writing something about this summer. Why does it matter that these things are terrorism? Is because terrorist offenses are treated much more seriously. Obviously, the punishment for doing a terrorist act is far more than for a non-terrorist act. But there's also a bunch of ancillary crimes that go along with terrorism. One of them is that harboring or concealing terrorists is a terrorist offense itself. And the other is that material support for terrorists is a terroristic offense. And that includes expert advice or assistance. So for those of you who want the expert advice or assistance of somebody like a lawyer, and if you come and tell me that you're involved in something terroristic, the question then is am I now a terrorist if I give you my expert advice on those issues? So it greatly broadens the kind of people who are caught up who are ancillarily caught up in the enforcement of these terrorism laws. And the fact that these are new terrorist offenses not only means greater sentences, but it also means new surveillance power, okay? The unauthorized access law, which is 18 U.S.C. 1030, some people call it the anti-hacking law. It really doesn't have anything to do with hacking. It defines certain kinds of illegal hacking, so I just call it 1030. But it allows wiretapping for 1030. Previously, that was not allowed. 1030 was not a predicate offense for a Title III warrant, and it increased the penalties. What was once a misdemeanor for accessing stored electronic communications is now a 5-year felony, and what was once a 5-year felony, the unauthorized access, is now a 10-year felony. Okay, so I think you can see from that the Patriot Act is not the greatest expansion of government surveillance powers in our time. But it is an expansion of surveillance powers in several key areas, and it's really a hint of what's next to come. But for whatever disagreements people might have with me on government surveillance, I think that we can generally agree that the new FISA rules, are a real change. The FISA stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And basically, this allows spying based on a reduced judicial oversight if the purpose of the surveillance was the investigation of American agents of a foreign government or foreign agents here on American soil. Now, after the USAPA, this type of spying is permitted not if the purpose is, but if a significant purpose of the surveillance is to investigate these agents of foreign governments. Previously, there was a barrier between foreign intelligence and law enforcement. Now, under the new rules, there's information sharing permitted between foreign intelligence and law enforcement. That includes law enforcement wiretap results, grand jury investigations, and perhaps more concern, the FISA wiretaps, which are obtainable without probable cause, can now be shared with law enforcement if the person is suspected of being an agent for foreign government. Okay, so that's a real reduction and a possible end run around our usual standards for privacy protection. Okay, so that's my discussion of the USAPA, and that is now currently law. I'm going to talk about two proposed areas of legislation, just so you know what's coming down the pike, and then I'm going to take questions. The first is the Cybersecurity Enhancement Act, or or CSEA, which has passed the House and is now awaiting approval in the Senate. And I think that absent some kind of great mobilization, that's going to happen. And the second is a proposal that has passed neither House nor Senate and hopefully might not see the light of day. This is the copyright holder hack back legislation, which has just been introduced in the House. Okay, CSEA modifies 18 U.S.C. 1030, which, as I told you, is the anti-hacking law. Section 1, and I have the section references here so you guys can look this up for yourself if you like. It increases penalties for the transmission of, it increases penalties for the under 1030 from now 10 years under Patriot Act to 20 years, and it creates a new term of potential life imprisonment if the offender knowingly or recklessly causes or attempts to cause death through unauthorized access or the transmission of harmful information. Okay, so you'll hear about life sentences for hackers, and it doesn't mean life sentences for every hacker, but it does mean for if you're trying to use hacking to create, to cause death. Okay, now, if anybody has any examples of any times in the past in which this has actually happened, I'd be interested in hearing about those, but I think we can see that, you know, once again, on this very shaky foundation of the concept of unauthorized access, we're piling on these very, very serious consequences. And let me just say that I don't think that life imprisonment is really going to be a deterrent to people like the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. These are not people who care much about life in prison. They don't care about dying. I'm not sure. And I think that that's one of the things that that legislators really need to understand, which is that laws, the criminal laws, can only go so far in protecting us. What we need is actual physical security. And the laws alone are not going to be enough. Okay, and finally, Section 101 of the CSEA asks the Sentencing Commission to reevaluate the sentencing guidelines under which all types of unauthorized access offenses are sentenced. There are also new provisions under this law, should it pass, which deal with the interception and collection of stored communications, which we talked a lot about with USAPA. It changes the interception of private cell phone communications and treats those the same as interceptions of communications sent over traditional media. It also increases the penalties for that type of interception to 5 years when the actor has the requisite criminal intent. It changes the range of situations in which ISPs may voluntarily disclose information to law enforcement under a much greater range of circumstances. It opens up the idea of when there's an emergency from an objective, reasonable person belief to the good faith of the ISP. So even if it is objectively unreasonable that this was an emergency, if the ISP in good faith believed that it was an emergency, then it's okay for them to give law enforcement the information. And the provider can then disclose the information not just to law enforcement, but to any government entity. So if they find some information about biological warfare or something like that, they don't have to give it to the FBI. They could also give it to the Center for Disease Control or something like that. The pen register trap and trace order can be used in two new emergency situations. Both immediate threats to national security and ongoing attacks on protected computers, so to try to intercept crimes as they occur. And it clarifies something that was pretty much always true, that communications providers obviously can't be criminally prosecuted when all they're doing is executing government-obtained search warrants or search orders that were authorized by the court. That was always true. Okay. So again, I say that that is not a that is not already passed, but that is legislation that's currently passed the House and pending in the Senate. And finally, we're going to talk about the hackback legislation. This is a law which would set, give copyright holders the ability to and the right to disable or interfere with peer-to-peer file trading networks on which their copyrighted information may be being shared or traded. So I'll just, for those in the back, it limits copyright holders' civil and criminal liability for disabling, interfering with, blocking, diverting, or impairing the unauthorized distribution, display, or reproduction of his copyrighted work on a peer-to-peer file trading network. So the law wasn't enough to stop peer-to-peer file trading. Now that they're going to bring out the hackers. And so you're going to have the RIAA hackers out there trying to shut down peer-to-peer networks and the peer-to-peer network hackers out there trying to keep them up. I'm not taking bets on this particular fight, but... Yeah, it's going to keep a lot. There's money in it for everybody. I'll get to your question in a second. There's money in it for everybody. I just want to make clear, I mean, there's been a lot of hyperbole about the law. It doesn't really give them the permission to go log onto, just because you're trading files, it doesn't give them the permission to log onto your computer and read everything that you've got there. You're going to have to read your real network's terms of service for that. But it does allow them to try to disable peer-to-peer networks. So that is a law that's been introduced in the House. It has not yet been passed in either the House or the Senate. But it's sort of, a copyright industry wish list. And I think raises a lot of technological issues that Congress is probably not aware of, never mind the sociological ones. Okay, so once again, what can I do? You are going to be able to ask questions. Once again, what can I do? Call or write your congressperson about these laws. Get educated and pay attention. And once again, I list the ACLU and the EFF website there. I also list a website about suvalence, which I cannot do justice to describe here. But I encourage you guys to check out this URL that I have here. It is, and I forget the gentleman's name right now. I'm sure some people out there know. But it is a project by a gentleman from the Media Lab at MIT about watching the watchers and taking portable cameras and wearable cameras into places where normally you're observed and observing them back. So there's great films of him filming the security cameras at like 7-Elevens and stuff and hotels, and then the security people from the 7-Elevens and hotels coming up and trying to tell him he's not allowed to film there. So it's very amusing. It's very artistic, and it has a great underlying political message that it gets to. So if you like to approach your activism and politics from the fun side, that's a good way to look at it. Okay, that's the end. I just want to mention that for this presentation, I give special thanks to my summer intern this year, Matthew Sherb, and now I'm ready to take questions. I'm going to take the gentleman who I saw over there, unless he's gone. Oh, yes, you in the card shirt. Okay, the question is, under Hackback, what gives me the right to do that? What makes me a copyright holder? And basically, anybody who creates anything is a copyright holder. If you created original work, and you create original work and you put it in a fixed medium, you are now a copyright holder. And if you're copyrighted, there's no need to register it or anything like that. And if your copyrighted material is being traded without authorization over this network, then go for it. There's no civil or criminal liability for you. There's somebody over here who... The question is, who introduced the Hackback legislation? I don't remember. I think it... I could guess. But Berman. Mr. Berman. The Berman legislation.
Yes.
Hollywood.
Disney himself.
Okay.
How does HIPAA play into your 1030 example?
How does HIPAA, the privacy legislation, play into my 1030? Can you clarify?
No, you were talking about healthcare.
I know that there are privacy provisions for healthcare information. I'm not an expert on that, and I don't know that there's any kind. I don't know what the criminal penalties are under that for accessing this information. Under 1030, it's more about where you're impairing somebody's medical data, which affects their treatment or diagnosis. And HIPAA may have criminal sanctions just for the sheer invasion of privacy. This goes somewhat beyond that, but I'm not a HIPAA expert. Okay. In the yellow shirt there in the back.
You talked about providing expert guidance to somebody who's about to do domestic terrorism. Is there a requirement for the person providing the guidance to know that person is thinking about doing this? I'm wondering about people answering questions on IRC or email.
So the question is there any kind of requirement that you know that the person you're helping is a domestic terrorist in order to be liable under the terrorism rule? And the answer is yes. It's not a strict liability crime in almost every... In most criminal offenses, there's some kind of knowledge requirement. But for a lawyer, for example, I can know that my client was involved in something that's, arguably domestic terrorism and still feel that under, the rules of the system, I should be allowed to give them my expert advice, even if that expert advice is something like, you got to turn yourself in. Still, you know, you don't want to. So there may be knowledge even in innocent types of circumstances where you're not really a collaborator and you're not really intending to further the terroristic act. I'm going to call on this very eager gentleman.
Does that apply to unsolicited articles on the web?
Does that apply to unsolicited requests for information on the web?
No. Say you put out an article on the web that gives a very nice way of bringing in something that might lead to something bringing in somewhere that would be much more thought, you know, so bad and terrible. Mm-hmm. You then take the onus that you put it out there. You're the guy that said, hey, this can be done this way.
The question is, do these rules against helping terrorists apply to information that you may publish in articles and then publish on the web, where you're publishing some information about how to break into it and it's possible that terrorists would use it? And I think the answer to that is still no. You still may publish that information, and those, you know, I don't think that at this point in time we can have rules against that because we still have the First Amendment, and you also don't know that it's going to be used for terroristic offense. It could be used for a variety of other legitimate purposes, though perhaps you might want to have a couple of those legitimate purposes in mind before you post it. Just in case somebody comes and asks some questions. I'm going to take this gentleman to look.
Vague wording of CC, CSEA.
Mm-hmm.
It says knowingly or recklessly and attempts. Someone breaks into, is hacking around, playing around, some script kitty breaks into a hospital computer and shuts down their systems. Someone doesn't get their meds on time, almost dies, but doesn't die. Does that qualify?
So the question is with no...
What do you mean to do it?
Right. The question is, under CSEA, whether if it's knowingly or recklessly attempts, what happens when some script kiddie breaks into a hospital and messes up somebody's hospital records by accident? And I think that the problem is that's arguably reckless. I mean, you're in the hospital, you're not supposed to be in there, you're messing around with stuff you don't understand, and that's reckless conduct. And as a result, somebody's medical information is altered and somebody may get hurt, and arguably that section does apply because it doesn't require that was your actual intent. The other thing is anytime you have an attempt crime, you're always talking about what's in the person's, the suspect or the perpetrator's mind. What did they intend to do? And intent is always a very fuzzy concept. And I think that one of the problems we have in this area is that to an outsider, sometimes when you're messing around with a computer network, that may all seem like illegitimate intent. And so automatically, you're presumed to, it's easier for the jury or the judge to assume you had a more negative intent than you may have. The idea that, oh, I was just looking around doesn't make a lot of intuitive sense to people who are not computer savvy. Okay. I'm going to pay some attention to this side of the room. I'll take this gentleman. So for those of you in the back, his question was, what about designing and selling an inherently insecure system? Maybe that's reckless. And that is not currently the law, and I have some doubts that the Department of Justice would tend to interpret the law that way should it go into effect. There have not yet been any civil cases, to my knowledge, in which the vendors of insecure software have been sued. Some people have hypothesized that insurance will create an incentive to build more secure software, but we certainly haven't seen that to be the case yet. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is trying to educate people and fight against these types of proposed laws that I think are bad. I think it would be great if we could introduce a bad law of our own, which would create vendor liability for unreasonably insecure software, and try to get that pushed through the Congress. So if anybody feels like working on that, let me know. This gentleman here. Yes, you.
I had a question regarding the USAPA and the disclosure of open versus unopened email.
Okay.
I was curious what your thoughts were on why it's structured that way. I would tend to think personally that open email is much more time sensitive.
The question is, why does the USAPA, and it's not, this was true under the ECPA too, prior to the USAPA, why does it treat opened and unopened email differently? And I think that's a good question. Essentially, unopened email they wanted to treat just like they treat a real letter, you know, a physical paper letter, so you need a search warrant. An opened email that you leave on the server is considered to be somehow less private because you've opened it, but you've left it there. And, you know, the statute is notoriously unclear, and there's been a lot of debates over it. Congress just sort of makes these decisions about what level of privacy something enjoys. But I, just like with voicemail, I think you're talking about the same type of communication. It's open or unopened status shouldn't matter. And also in the statute, which I didn't mention because I didn't want to get too technical, if your email's been left on the server for is opened and left on the server for less than 180 days, it's treated differently than if it's left on the server for more than 180 days. So they're drawing some very fine types of privacy distinctions there, and I'm not entirely sure why they want to make those considerations. Okay, I will take this gentleman with the blondish hair. What does Patriot stand for? It is the Act to provide appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. Okay. The gentleman way in the back with the glasses.
Can you say a word about how these laws authorized things like secret burglary in the case where they couldn't break in out of the encryption so they put a keyboard number on his machine?
Okay, so the question is about secret burglaries or black bag jobs or sneak and peek type of warrants. And this bill increases, and I think I kind of mentioned it in passing, but I'm glad you brought it up. It increases the situations in which there's no necessity for notice to be given to the person who's being surveilled. It extends that period of time. So it authorizes installing the secret installing of sniffers. Now, this actually was true, I have to say, prior to USAPA. In a New Jersey case, they broke into this alleged mob guy's house, installed a, I think it was a keystroke sniffer or keystroke collector on his computer, and then were able to use that information in his prosecution. And the defense argued that you needed a Title III warrant to collect that information, and all they had was a search warrant to go in. They didn't have the special warrant to monitor the information that he was sending out on the network. And the FBI said, well, actually, we configured this thing to only collect keystrokes when he wasn't online. So none of that was actually in the process of being transmitted. And no, I'm sorry, defense attorneys, you can't look at it. We're just going to show the judge how that's true. And so they ended up letting that information in. Under Patriot Act, there's increased ability to do that with devices like Magic Lantern, which is a sniffer you can send over email to an unsuspecting person. This gentleman in the glasses. The question is, does using encryption increase your expectation of privacy? And that is an unsettled area of the law, as is much of this stuff. I think that the argument is that you have, and there's two different ways of looking at it. I've expressed that I expect this information to be private because I've encrypted it, and then on the other side, that this information is the encryption is sort of like a box, but it doesn't have anything to do with the privacy of the information itself. So this is something that's debated in law review articles, but there is no concrete answer to that question at this time. Okay, I'm going to take two more questions, and then I'm going to be done. I'll take this person waving frantically over here.
What about vulnerability disclosure?
The question is vulnerability disclosure, and what about that? It doesn't have necessarily relate to what I've spoken about today, but I think that we are all familiar with the DMCA, which I believe I spoke about last year, and I know that there's been a lot of concern that disclosure of vulnerabilities in an exploit code and that kind of thing could be something that companies use the DMCA to go after. And this is really something that's worth it. At least a whole nother hour, if not another, you know, if not another day. But essentially, the question is, is disclosing vulnerabilities or exploit code or that kind of thing, does that help you circumvent some kind of protection that was put in place to control access to a copyrighted work?
Let me clarify that. Point here. If I publish a vulnerability, which is could be construed as a
terrorism, such as infrastructure, you know, problem. Wouldn't that fall into them saying, well, hey, you know, you knew what you were doing and terrorists can get this information, therefore you're colluding in something?
The question is, what if my vulnerability can be used by terrorists to do some kind of attack, and am I then colluding with terrorists? And I think that my answer goes back to the answer I gave earlier about how you're still allowed to publish information that's not classified or anything like that. You're still allowed to publish that information because we have the First Amendment, and you don't know how it's going to be used. It could also be used for a good purpose, but you just want to maybe have a few of those in mind in case anybody asks. But I think you're still allowed to do that. Now I'm going to take one from this side. I'll take that gentleman who's had his hand up for a long time. Are there limitations on the enforcement of the USAPA for computers outside of the United States? And I have to admit, this is not a big specialty of mine, but these rules apply to computers in the United States. Our law enforcement and foreign intelligence services have much greater leeway with people outside of United States jurisdiction. And I don't, like I said, I don't know a lot about this, but there are different rules for American citizens outside of the United States and then non-American citizens outside of the United States, but the rules are much more lax. We treat our own people much better than we treat others. So, okay, and with that, I'll be available for questions outside, but if you don't get a chance to talk to me, then feel free to send me email at the address that you see above. Thank you.